You're listening to Both Sides of the Stethoscope, where medicine meets the human heart. This podcast is hosted by me, Dr. Colby Salerno, a cardiologist, and my co-host, Dr. Aline Grigosian, an ICU doctor. What makes our podcast unique? We've both had heart transplants. Join us as we blend our medical expertise with personal journeys, aiming to educate and foster understanding between doctors and patients. From cutting-edge medical discussions to personal reflections, welcome to a podcast that explores the heartbeat of healthcare and the shared experience that connects us all. Let's get on with the episode. This episode is sponsored by Paragonix Technologies, an industry leader committed to protecting the gift of organ donation. To learn how Paragonix is reshaping the standard of care across transplantation to optimize patient outcomes, visit paragonix.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Both Sides of the Stethoscope. We have another fantastic guest on today's episode. As always, I am one of your hosts, Colby Salerno, here with my co-host, Aline Grigosian.
Hi, everyone.
We have the pleasure of welcoming on Dr. Thomas Maxey. Dr. Maxey is a board-certified cardiothoracic surgeon with a focus on treating congenital heart defects in people of all ages, especially newborn babies. He specializes in surgical repair of congenital heart defects, palliation of single ventricle heart disease, mechanical support, and heart transplants. Dr. Maxey serves as the chair of cardiothoracic surgery at Atrium Health Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, and was named an Atrium Health Physician of the Quarter and has been named a top doctor by Charlotte Magazine for multiple years. Welcome on, Dr. Maxey.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on our show. And I think we initially met on Instagram, Dr. Maxey, back maybe a year or two ago. I know you do a lot of fun content on Instagram about education and awareness about heart transplant, especially in pediatric patients. So we really appreciate that.
No, it's fun. I work with a great group of people, and I'm not the brains behind that. So my PAs are great folks, and they're my video people and editors, and they run the show behind the scenes.
They're awesome. Just to get started, so what inspired you to specialize in pediatric, I guess, congenital heart disease and transplantation? What got you on the path to what you're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not like most other surgeons that you know or have interviewed. I definitely took a circuitous route to get here. You know, I probably couldn't even spell surgeon when I was in high school. I went in the military when I got out of high school and, you know, was kind of a late bloomer. I was on the path to be, you know, in sports medicine. I was really intrigued by that kind of world. And I had an anatomy and physiology professor in college who was a heart transplant recipient himself. And this was out west. I think, Ellen, where you are, we were in Orange County, California. Just a great individual. And man, was I intrigued by what this guy had to say. And you can imagine his cardiovascular lectures. You know, he was a great teacher as it was, but as a heart transplant recipient, his cardiovascular lectures were absolutely amazing. And he introduced me to his thoracic surgeon that actually did his transplant. This was at UCLA. And then he and I became close friends. And I mean, it was just a switch that just flipped. I couldn't fathom doing anything else in my life, you know, after that introduction. There's 1,000 subplots in that story, but you know, just kind of stumbled into it, to be quite honest with you. And you know, the congenital world is very unique. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, not the typical path of most cardiac surgeons to land where I am. So I'm very lucky.
And tell us a little bit about what the training looks like in order to get to the level of being a pediatric heart surgeon.
Yeah, so I'm an old guy now. I did the, you know, the traditional route, which now you have a couple different options. But so I went to med school for 4 years, just like y'all did. And then I did general surgery after that. I matched in general surgery, which is 5 clinical years. We actually had 2 years of research in the middle of that. So after your third year, you went into the lab for 2 years. And you know, I went into a cardiac lab doing ischemia reperfusion injury with transplant, and you know, kind of always had a spin on that. Finished up my general surgery, and then I did 3 years of cardiothoracic training. That was at Emory in Atlanta. That was, you know, adult cardiothoracic training. And then I did an additional 2 years of a congenital heart surgery fellowship after that. So whatever that adds up to, a long time. So 12 years of residency after after med school. So a long haul. Not a fun haul, by the way. I take that back. It was fun. It certainly wasn't easy. That's what I meant to say.
Are you going to tell us that things were much different back then than they are now?
I didn't have the 80-hour work week or any of that.
That is crazy.
You know, it was a long haul. I spent every other to every third night in the hospital for 12 years. And, you know, it sounds kind of ridiculous now, but it was kind of fun at the time, you know, because that's where everybody was. You know, it wasn't, you know, you just didn't have one intern holding down the fort for, you know, the entire hospital, like the whole crew was there. So,
right, exactly. And that's what I hear a lot from people who trained. I don't want to call you old, Dr.
You
Matt.
Can.
People who trained prior to the 80-hour work week,
yeah.
You know, as much as they hated it, they also loved it. So it's interesting to hear about. So can you kind of describe the process of determining when a child, particularly one with congenital heart disease, might need a transplant and any other specific things regarding congenital heart disease and when they need surgery?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, so the pediatric, meaning less than 18, the pediatric heart transplant world is probably about 1/10 of the volume of the adult, you know, the adult cardiac right. transplant world. So I don't have numbers right here in front of me, but, you know, 400 or 500 of these are done a year, I would say, you know, in the country, and they're probably done at about 50 centers. So it's a much smaller overall program than adult cardiac transplant. So the, you know, the population is unique. The overwhelming majority of the kids that I transplant, you know, have had previous surgery. I mean, there's a couple kids, not too often, that have, you know, a cardiomyopathy or something of that nature, a teenager, you know, who needs a heart transplant. But the vast majority of the kids that I operate on, 90% of them that I transplant, have congenital heart disease and have had previous operations. And I would say the overwhelming majority of those are what we call single ventricle heart disease. You're born with, you know, one half of your heart with inadequate volume to do the work that we need. So you go through a series of operations where I describe it as robbing Peter to pay Paul. You know, we kind of jerry-rig the system so we can get blood flow to the body and blood flow to the lungs. And it, you know, it's not a long-term fix. It's a palliative operation. And at some point, all of those people need a transplant. And in the ideal world, I'd like to get them out until they're 20, but, you know, it's not uncommon that they're 5 and need a heart transplant. So again, it's a totally different world than the adults. Most of the kids that I'm transplanting, I've operated on previously, 3 years ago, 10 years ago. So, you know, kind of already know them and know their family. So I think that's unique, a different aspect than the adult world.
I work in adult cardiology, as I mentioned before, and I work in our adult congenital heart disease clinic.
Oh, great.
Your patients are living longer and longer with the, you know, types of palliative procedures that you're able to do at such young ages. So I have a couple questions. One, do you follow these patients into adulthood? And two, the ones that make it, you know, past 20, some even into their 30s, who then eventually develop, you know, severe heart failure and need a transplant. Mm-hmm. Are you their transplant surgeon or are you working with adult transplant surgeons? How does that work?
Yeah. So Colby, I thank you for what you do. So we kind of work hand in hand. So I don't personally follow the patients, you know, from childhood into adulthood. So they typically follow with their pediatric cardiologist. We have a heart failure team here as well, but if they don't need heart failure, they're following with their typical, you know, cardiology follow-up, depending on what their congenital heart disease is. Then they transition when they're 18 or 20 into the ACHD world, which is what you're doing, adult congenital heart disease. Now, should they have heart failure, you know, kind of depending on where they are, they're going to land in either the adult, you know, the adult heart failure world or you know, our pediatric heart failure world. But should they need a transplant, regardless of their age, if they have congenital heart disease, I'm their surgeon. Even without a transplant, I'm a congenital heart surgeon. That doesn't mean I'm a baby heart surgeon. I operate on people with congenital heart disease. You could be 62 and we found out that you have a hole in your heart or something of that nature that you were born with. But I do all the transplants in this hospital and the kids and have for, you know, 15 years. And, you know, the adults, congenital patients that need transplant, it's not that many, probably 2 a year. And that I do those operations as well.
And to follow up, you know, say you've done some congenital heart disease on a single ventricle patient, how do you go about discussing with them that eventually they will need a transplant and how to try and, you know, live their life with that sitting there in the back of their mind?
Yeah. Now that discussion actually starts in utero. I actually meet the parents. You know, most of these kids are diagnosed prenatally. And, you know, I don't get into too much detail, but I do describe, you know, I can't make one side of your kid's heart bigger. So we're going to go through a series of palliative operations, and I explain what that means. That means I don't fix anything, but, you know, I'm making the system work. But I'm clear from day one that, you know, it's not a long-term fix. A Fontan is not designed to get you to be 85 years old and die of, you know, whatever all the rest of us die of. You're not going to make it that far with that. So I describe it early on to the parents. And then as the kids are kind of teenager, we have a whole program here in Charlotte to where it's a transition program, and they're, you know, kind of entering that adult world, and that vocabulary is emphasized. It's, you know, probably not every single visit, but it's very clear that this is a palliative operation, that or series of operations that really don't fix your problem. At some point, you will need a transplant.
What is, from all the procedures that you do, including like the Fontan, for example, and I'll be mindful of the way I ask this because I used to date a surgeon, and one time I asked him like what a difficult procedure is, and his response was like, none of them are difficult for me. But oh, okay. which one of the multiple procedures that you do is the most technically difficult?
Yeah, so I'll answer that and maybe in two different angles, if you will. Mm-hmm. So today I did an arterial switch VSD closure on a baby with very complex congenital heart disease called Tausig-Bing. You know, very technically demanding operation, but the kids do very well after that. I describe it as a bimodal outcome, good or bad. And if you can get the coronaries and everything lined up, it's a very technically challenged operation. And I love it because the kids do well. There's not this, well, I'm going to operate on you again in 6 months and we'll do this again later. So that's probably my favorite operation that's technically challenging. But I would say the most challenging operation is what we call an AV canal, an atrioventricular canal. And that's because they're all different. You have one single valve separating the top chambers from the bottom chambers, large hole in the top and bottom. And you need to create a functional structure. Particularly, you need to make two valves out of the one AV valve. And as you guys know, the left one needs to work very well. The one that we'll call the mitral needs to open and close properly under high pressures. And, you know, on paper, it probably doesn't look like the most complex operation, but it is, because every single child's valves are different. So you've got to have about, you know, 10 different variants of techniques to be able to fix those and know which one of those variants to use at each time. So probably the most difficult for me would be an AV canal. If you interviewed a lot of other congenital heart surgeons, they probably wouldn't say that. I operate on much smaller babies that have, you know, more complex things. I'm sure you've all heard of the Norwood procedure and all this sort of stuff. That's basically, I mean, it's a complex operation, but it's pretty much the same operation on every single baby. I don't have a lot of variation in it, but a canal has tremendous variation.
That's really interesting. The reason why I ask is because a lot of people assume that heart transplant is such a difficult surgery. And I remember one thing that made me feel better before my transplant was the resident, or I don't remember if it was a fellow or the resident, but one of the trainees, not the attending, was like, hey, don't even worry. Like, this is basically just putting a new heart in and attaching five vessels. It's like the easiest thing we do. And I'm not saying that it's true, but it made me feel better. Like, it actually, I was like, okay, I guess that's good. You know, there isn't much to worry about, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I always found that interesting, but there are some patients who, you know, they always assume that any sort of transplant is the most, and I personally, in a CTICU setting where I take care of post-op mitral valve, you know, adults or adult patients who've gotten different procedures, I feel like some of them sound like they'd probably be more difficult. Again, I'm not a surgeon, but that's why I ask.
No, I totally get it. And to be quite honest with you, someone like you, you know, that's never had heart surgery before.
Right.
I mean, I literally tell the parents that I sew five circles together. I do much harder operations every single day than that. Now, that's not the case for someone with a failing Fontan.
Right, right.
His liver's congested. They've had five previous operations. Their platelets are 50. You know, their liver's ill. And
right.
That's a total, because I got to take all of that stuff down and make it look like you.
Right.
To then sew five circles together. But you're right. I have no problem saying it. It's certainly not the most difficult operation I do. I tell people, don't let that be public knowledge. So it's sexy. It gets a lot of pub, but technically speaking, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because that's exactly what my heart surgeon said to me before my transplant. He said, you know, this is actually a pretty easy surgery. Don't tell other people, though.
I say that phrase often.
Switching gears a little bit, the last episode we just did, we interviewed a mom who had three children who have had heart transplants. And, you know, it was very emotional talking to her, of course, not only with three babies having heart transplants, but of course, talking about organ donation in the pediatric population. So from your point of view as a surgeon, one, kind of how do you deal with families and patients? Is there any education that you feel needs to be done with each group? And second, is there any misconceptions in the pediatric transplant world that you would want to discuss?
You mean the recipient families?
Yes, the recipient families.
You know, it's a pretty clean run system. The recipients really do not know where the donors are coming from. You know, occasionally I have family members that ask that, but when I'm meeting them in consultation, you know, I probably need to get better vocabulary for this. Maybe I'll ask the two of you. You know, clearly a child has to die for me to get a heart for your kid. And when your baby is this big, you know, I don't have a lot of, you know, I don't have a lot of room there. So, you know, I'm pretty blunt with them straight up. You know, that's why kids can be on the wait list for prolonged periods of time, particularly if you're tiny. And we'll talk about ABO incompatibility and stuff like that in a second for little babies if you want. But, you know, generally speaking, when you're an adult, you can shop from a fairly large pool, if you will. I don't need to be crass about that. But, you know, when you're small, you're restricted by size and distance and blood type. And, you know, you got a few more variables that are there. But, you know, I'm honest with the families on the front end. They know what needs to happen on the other end, and it's a terrible situation. And to be quite honest with you, it's really never brought up, at least not to me, but by the families again. I think they're grateful, and they have frequently mentioned that at the time of the operation and even in follow-up and stuff. They're very grateful for the opportunity for their child to have a second chance in life due to, you know, an incredible gift of donation. What was the second thing you asked? I'm sorry.
Cole. Do you feel there are any misconceptions in the pediatric transplant world? You know, we see adult mostly, and Elaine is the medical director of an OPO. So, you know, she deals a lot with people who think, you know, there's a lot of myths
about things. How.
And yeah. I think there's a lot of trust in things that try and go into this. And I don't know if you see it in the pediatric world as much as we do in the adult world.
No, I don't think so. You know, some myths that, you know, to not even use that word, maybe some misunderstandings,
right.
You know, for the pediatric world, as I mentioned, clearly I need a small heart to fit into a baby. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But maybe some people really don't understand that, you know, as an infant, specifically under 18 months of age, your immune system is very naive. And because of that, I can cross blood types. I can almost always do what we call an ABO incompatible heart transplant, meaning that, you know, an A could take a B or whatever, which certainly opens up the pool a little bit. So that's a, you know, maybe a misconception that we're waiting for a blood type for our little baby. So most kids under the age of 18 months, we do a bunch of labs and stuff to make sure that they're, you know, are an ABO incompatible recipient. But that's kind of unique. And I'm actually proud to tell parents that the younger your child is, the better off they're going to do with a heart transplant. So, you know, the outcomes of a child under the age of one is fantastic with a heart transplant. Right. The longevity of the graft is twice that of what adults is.
Do they also have similar, I know the answer to this, Do you know why there aren't similar rates of graft dysfunction, like rejection, CAV, in patients who've received heart transplants prior to the age of one? Like, why is it that they don't really develop CAV over the years like adults do? Does anybody know?
I think their immune system is so naive. I'm not an immunologist. I probably can't get, in too depth of, real conversation about this. But, you and I, by the time you're five, you've been to preschool, you've licked dirt, you've eaten a popsicle off the ground, you've done all those kinds of things. And your immune system has kind of identified you as you. And it's hardwired at that point. But when you're one, your immune system is naive. I could trick it, if you will. So, maybe they have less of an inflammatory response, and it's just less of a more blunted, prolonged rejection. They all reject, as you
know. Right.
I like that rejection to occur over 30 years, not 30 months.
Right. Exactly. So it's rare for you to have to retransplant due to chronic rejection within a few years of transplant, right?
Specifically, if it were a baby, that would be very rare. When you kind of become teenager, you're kind of adult at that point.
Right. Interesting.
And I have transplanted several teenagers. They're still pediatric world, kind of 18 or so, that were transplanted, at 7 or 8 or something like that. So I've done several of those over the years.
I have a question that, as I mentioned, and this is more of interest from where I work and the patients I see, is the patients that you operate on, for example, and do a Fontan on, a female, they live much longer, and a lot of them are living now till childbearing age. Do they call you as a surgeon to be a part of their prenatal planning or anything? Or do you as a surgeon give them any counseling, or do you leave that to the, general, adult congenital cardiologist?
Yeah, our adult congenital cardiologist would handle all of that. Now, there's the rare exception of, a pregnant mom with congenital heart disease, Fontan or not, who's labile. I've had to put a couple of moms on ECMO. On peripheral ECMO during delivery. In fact, one just recently. But I'm not involved in that. That's the adult congenital group that are very well tuned in to single ventricle physiology and pregnancy, which is, there's another myth for you. You have single ventricle heart disease, you're Fontaned, you're a young lady in your 20s or 30s. We have many females in our local community here that have delivered more than one child successfully, really with no minimal complications.
Which maybe some of our listeners don't understand how incredible.
Isn't that amazing? That is amazing. We would not be having this conversation 20 years ago. I'm pretty confident about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing. In your opinion, how can society better support children who need heart transplants and their families? What is one thing that you think could be done better, especially in the pre-waiting period, which is probably when you see them most? Is there something that we can do to improve their care prior to them getting a transplant, or even in the initial perioperative period?
Yeah. And I'm talking to two unique individuals here. You two are physicians, have received heart transplants. We're very lucky people. You treat people, all three of us treat people who do not have the resources that we have, and whether they're adults or kids, we kind of see them from the time they get to the parking lot, into your office. You kind of step back a little bit and really think about the resources that these families need that live wherever, 2.5 hours, 3 hours away from Charlotte, North Carolina. They have one car, the dad works two jobs. They have four kids, one of them needing a heart transplant. I mean, I just pause and think about that for a second. The amount of resources and stress and unknown that's going on, for their kid who might need a heart transplant, for God's sakes. I don't know how to answer your question, though. If I can wave my magic wand, we would have unlimited resources for these families. But I think, I guess what I'm trying to get at is maybe understanding. we've turned down families for transplant because they don't have enough resources to get little Johnny to the hospital. I get it. I understand why that is. But if you just kind of sit back for a second and think about that, that's kind of, it's hard for me to say that. It's hard to listen to.
Right.
But true. So I don't know how to answer your question exactly. You know, what could we do as society to, you know, better prepare those people? You know, for me personally, it's just an understanding of them. You know, this is a person no different than my cousins or aunt and uncles, you know, back in my hometown, just limited resources, normal folk who are trying to navigate through a very complex healthcare system for their kid or their spouse, you know, getting a heart transplant, which is scary as hell. You know, you may not make it.
Right. I totally agree with that. I think that does answer my question. I guess in general, just caregiver educational resources. For me, I feel like even if we have the access to certain things, whether it's education or money or foundations that might pay for certain things, the main problem that I see, especially amongst families who are, you know, preparing for transplant for one of their kids or one of their loved ones, is the fact that they don't know where to even get those. Like, they don't even know how to go to which website or what resource to use for what. So even if we do have the resources, the access to it is what I feel like one of the major issues is.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would agree. You know, once they're into the system, you know, we have social workers and all of those kind of folks
that
help out. I mean, we give gas cards, we pay rent for people, you know, electric bills, all sorts of stuff that's, you know, kind of way beyond where I have my, you know, fingerprint on. But, you know, fortunately, I'm in a large center that can be able to provide that. I would imagine that most large transplant centers have those resources. But as you said, you know, I mean, you got to get in the door. You got to at least know that they're there. I don't think that's a battle that the three of us are going to solve in our lifetime.
No, not at all. I say those are the big issues. I'm just here to save lives overnight. That's all. not the bigger issues.
Yeah. No, well said. Well said.
I'm working on it. I have a small nonprofit called The Beat Goes On, and the idea is to try and help mostly young adults, 18 and older. When I started, I felt like there was more resources for children, but hearing you, I think there's more still that could be done. But the idea is still to try and help those who are facing some sort of hurdle while they're waiting a solid organ transplant. And I know, I apologize, I can't think of her name right now, but recently out of the Brigham, a doctor in adult heart transplant world started the Equity in Heart Transplant Fund. Mm-hmm. And then they give out grants constantly to patients who are awaiting heart transplants. And whether it's like 6 months to live in the Boston area for that time frame to get the transplant, stuff like that. And they're giving out grants. So can we do that at every hospital that does heart transplants in this country? No. But would I love to see local communities somehow finding support for their transplant population? That would be my ideal goal.
Lofty.
I know.
as Aline makes fun of me sometimes for being so lofty.
I think the, you know, and it's so cool that you're into it, Colby. The adult congenital world is a unique, you know, relatively new specialty. You know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago when we did, you know, the exact operation I did this morning on a baby, you know, a good chance those babies didn't make it specifically into adulthood. Now, fortunately, from the skill of my predecessors, they're all living. So, you know, I like to say you're born with congenital heart disease and you're going to die with congenital heart disease, but you don't die of congenital heart disease. So, you know, they do very well. But I think the, you know, kind of lack of understanding of, oh, I have a zipper on the front of my chest. I had heart surgery when I was a kid. You need constant follow-up. You know that very well, Colby, in the world that you're tiptoeing in now. But I would amplify that in the single ventricle population. All of those people will need a transplant. They might be 4, they might be 44, but all of them will. And the hardest operation that I do is a failing Fontan, fifth time redo, liver failure, kidneys don't work. I don't want to meet you in that scenario. I would like to make this an elective kind of thing. We're following you. And, you know, I'm very blunt with patients. I'm going to hurt you before I help you. I need you to have a little bit of reserve to be able to take a punch. You know, and when I meet you and you're so debilitated because you've been out of the healthcare system for 15 years and hadn't seen your cardiologist, you know, you kind of fallen off the curve a little bit. So I would like to, you know, for the physicians that are on board, if you have patients with congenital heart disease, they need to be seen by an adult congenital heart specialist. They need an echo, they need CT, they need follow-up, they need whatever it is. Don't let those patients fall off the cliff. And for the patients out there that are above the age of 18 and you got a scar down the front of your chest, you need to go see a doctor. You need to go see your cardiologist. Yeah, it doesn't mean you need heart surgery, but it's nice to be in the system to be closely followed.
No, I think that's an amazing point. And I'm not going to go into adult congenital specifically, but I love working with that population. And as an advanced heart failure and transplant physician, I hope to work hand in hand with them in those populations that hit, you know, older ages that are facing possible transplant. The anatomy and physiology is some of the most fascinating stuff I feel like you can ever see in medicine, where you're just trying to figure out how blood gets to where it needs to go. Yeah. But, you know, I just wanted to touch on some of the points you made. And that's, we just celebrated 10 years of the Adult Congenital Heart Disease Clinic at my hospital. And, you know, you look at these patients' charts and their notes and their list goes on and on because they had 8 surgeries before the age of 5. And the thing is, though, then all of a sudden they'll walk into your office at the age of 30 and you couldn't ever know that they had undergone that. Yep. And so I just second what Dr. Maxey's saying. That's, if you have a scar on the front of your chest and you still feel, but you're living your life and you feel fine, still make sure you're seeing your adult congenital heart disease doctor every year, because you know, they just need to be tracked and make sure that you're doing great. And if it's just a quick hello, your echo looks fantastic, see you in a year, that's really the best we could ever ask for.
Well said, my man.
Totally agree. We've had a couple of patients, especially when I was in fellowship in the CTICU, who were in their 30s and literally, like what you said, they were lost to follow-up and they ended up cardiac arrest in the CTICU. And at least one of them ended up getting eventually got a transplant. But yeah, like his family had assumed that because of whatever congenital disease that he had been operated on when he was a kid.
Yeah.
He was fine. So he didn't even like follow up for a very long time. And it was, you know, I've seen it at least a couple of times. So I think it's absolutely important to continue to follow up.
I actually enjoy talking to my teenage patients because, you know, their parents are sitting right there. I said, do you mind if I talk to your kid like a young man? And 99% of them say, yeah. And I lay that on the line. You know, the decision we're making today when talking about valve surgery or what have you is going to affect you 10, 15 years from now when you're here with your wife, not mommy and daddy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a good kind of, I take pride in educating my patients. They can all describe what operations they've had. They know what mechanical valves are in what position and how much Coumadin they take and what their INR is. You know, I wished everybody would do that, but I kind of take pride in that. I like my patients to be smart. Should they move to, you know, Connecticut and meet you, Colby, I want an 18-year-old kid to say, yeah, I've got a mechanical valve in the aortic position. I take this much Coumadin, this is my INR. Don't touch me, doc.
Yeah, I want that too.
Yeah, it's good.
I just want to say thank you so much, Dr. Maxey, for coming on and, you know, sharing parts of your career and your job and hopefully providing some nice insight to our listeners. We've had a lot of questions recently about pediatric heart transplantation. So hopefully we answered some of those listeners' questions.
I hope so. Thanks for having me. Let's do it again. It was fun.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Both Sides of the Stethoscope with your hosts, me, Aline Gregosian, and Colby Salerno. You can reach us at bothsidesofthestethoscope@gmail.com. You can also find us on both Instagram and Twitter. Our handles are Both Sides of the Stethoscope on Instagram and BSOT Stethoscope on Twitter or X. So you can find us on Both Sides of the Stethoscope on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Feel free to share or subscribe to our podcast. And if you really enjoy listening to us, we'd love to get a positive review.